Today is January 20th, 1994. This is Margaret Van Cleve. I will be interviewing Doug Cope, a lifelong Alaskan, a mining engineer with experiences ranging from survey crew work for the Army Corps of Engineers during World War II, superintendent of Yusa Valley Coal Mine in Healy, to instructor for the School of Mines and Mineral Industry at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Also present is his wife, Marcia Cope. This tape is made possible by a grant from Igloo No. 4 Foundation, Pioneers of Alaska. We are recording in the Cope's home in downtown Fairbanks, Alaska. Yeah, there you've spent most of your life in Fairbanks. You grew up in southeastern Alaska, near Petersburg. What is it like living on an island without nearby neighbors and the conveniences that we take for granted today?
It was what we take for granted today is the same thing as we took in those days. We didn't know any difference. We were only 5 miles from Petersburg. We didn't see anybody else except ourselves for months at a time. And sometimes, even though the Fox Ranchers that lived on Sauk Island, only a mile away, in the wintertime, stormy seas, we never visited very often. And then the other neighbors, 7, 8 miles away, we saw less often than we saw everybody every summer, of course, several times. But during the winter, when the southeasters were blowing, we were more or less isolated to our little world.
What were some of your recollections of caring for the foxes?
Well, as stated, my father started this ranch, this fox ranch, in 1916, and we had it until 1928, when he had to get out of the fox ranches for business for economic reasons. And life on the farm was very excellent. We enjoyed every part of it. We had lots of work to do keeping we had silver foxes, which were pen raised, and that they required a lot of attention, and that meant cooking feed in a 50-gallon open furnace, steel bowl embedded into a concrete furnace, and the ingredients in the 50-gallon steel bowl was always mainly fish, cracklings, which included a lot of suet, and oatmeal, some cornmeal, and so forth. And after that would cool, and we'd take it out in 5-gallon buckets or smaller pails, and put the feed in the box, in individual box pans.
At what time of year did you usually market the fox?
In the spring of the year, we'd market all the fox pelts. We'd pelt in the spring, when the fur was prime, and then the fox fur buyers would accumulate in Petersburg, and all the fox ranchers would bring in their pelts and sell their pelts to the fox pelt buyers. Mm-hmm. in the summertime, of course, was spent in accumulating all the feed for these foxes. We'd have to set nets out to catch thousands of fish and bring them in and clean each one. And we had a smokehouse that stood about 10 stories high. That is stories. When I say stories, they don't mean 10 stories like you think of a house, but it meant that the building was high, probably 20 feet high, room for about 20 or 10 stacks of fish, and they're about 20 feet by 20 feet in diameter or in area, and 20 feet high, and that would give us several thousand fish at a time. And we'd put them in there and smoke them and dry them and then stack them away for use for fox feed in the wintertime. So that's how most of our feed was accumulated.
All right, so your father was in business for about 11 years?
Yes, he was in business about 11 years. He started the business in 1916, and the peak of the fox ranching business, as far as economics is concerned, was 1925. Those smart ranchers that bailed out about that time or sold their ranches or got out of the business by 1925, some of them made fortunes. And those of us who weren't that brilliant or decided to sweat it out, lost our shirts. My father always said that the skin game skinned him. And we didn't get out of the business until we lost about everything we had, and we were forced to move to Fairbanks or to Petersburg for work.
Well, while you're living on the fox farm, what did you do about school?
My mother taught us with using the Calvert School lessons, and she did that for 5 years. Then on the sixth year, we had a lady come out and teach us during the sixth grade. And then we moved into Petersburg for the seventh grade.
So you and your younger brother were the only two students in this school. And by school, was this a separate building on the...
No, it was for the first 5 years, it was the same building.
So it was in your home?
In our home. For the sixth grade, it was a separate building.
This is where your teacher that lived. Was hired to come in
yes.
Lived, and then that was also the classroom as well.
Schoolroom.
Yeah. Describe your house that you lived in there. Was it a log cabin?
Well, it was partly log and partly frame. It was built alongside of big spruce trees. That kind of held it up in two spots, the front end and the side of the building. It was a two-room house. The kitchen was a living room, a combination. All-around room was probably 14 by 20. And the bedroom in the back was about 10 by 12 or 14. And we had bunks in there. Our mattresses were made from spruce branches. And the bunks were built up 6-8 inches high, and those 6-8 inches were filled with spruce boughs.
So they were cut in lengths of about a foot?
We were cut in lengths of small lengths of a few inches to a foot and tucked in just right. It took quite a savvy and experience to put in a bed that was comfortable and didn't puncture your ribs at night. But and of course, the longer that you use the bed, the less needles on the tree. They were dropping off, so three or four times a year, those branches, the mattress had to be replaced. And we didn't have any facilities. We carried our water in and we carried it out. And we carried our water from a creek that was about 100 feet away. And we had an outhouse that was on the creek below our water hole. And that was a cold experience to go out down there in the winter time in 3 or 4 or 5 feet of snow. But it gave us kept us warm, shoveling snow and cutting wood and burning the wood. So we were always busy all the time.
Physically fit with that kind of a regimen.
That's right.
What did you do about staples? I suppose you did purchase a few items like flour and sugar.
That's right. We did furnish. We had to furnish some flour and sugar and milk and a few things like that, macaroni and spices, of course. But we raised most of our things. We put up all the fish we wanted, salting and drying. All the meat we had, either fresh meat or salt meat or smoked meat. The year round, we had the beach in front of our house was loaded with clams, so any low tide, we could go down there with a bucket and get a bucket of clams. And our garden in the summertime was always loaded with the cabbage and potatoes and turnips and beets and carrots and things like that. We had a root house that was filled with sand in bins, so we put all our vegetables from our garden in sand and covered them lightly and dug them out a few at a time whenever we needed, and that seemed to preserve the vegetables. We had fairly fresh potatoes and cabbage and carrots, turnips, rutabagas in the spring of the year. I don't remember a whole lot of spoilage, probably a little, some spoilage in cabbage, of course. But most of the cabbage, instead of putting it in the sand like that, we made sauerkraut in 20-gallon drums, wooden barrels. Mm-hmm. And we had a half a dozen, 25 or 30 chickens, so that gave us all the eggs we wanted. So we were pretty self-sufficient that way.
Sounds like you ate well.
We ate well, and no, we never missed a meal. Probably postponed a few, but never missed any.
Oh, tell me about your experiences going from a one-room schoolhouse, so to speak, with you and your brother and teacher, mother in the first five grades, and then the teacher that came for a year. What was it like suddenly being with other kids and being in a classroom with maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 other students? Was that quite an adjustment?
Well, it certainly was, and I don't recommend it for anybody. Maybe I was one of the exceptions, but I had an awful lot of trouble trying to adjust myself to other people. I was never around people my own age. All the friends I had were grown men and women, and so I had no knowledge of how to get along with people of my peers. So my first year into town, which was the seventh grade, I had a horrible time. I probably spent a lot more time in the principal's office than I did in my own classroom. And I was big and I was strong, and I used every bit of
muscle I had. I probably licked everybody in school, and including one of the principals. Why I wasn't expelled, I'll never know, but they must have considered the source and tolerated the greenhorn that they got from a particular fox ranch.
So by this time, the whole family was living in Petersburg?
That's right. We were living in Petersburg, and my father was working on one of the shrimp boats. And we'd already purchased another home in Petersburg. And that was a year my sister came along, and the family, my brother and I and my sister, we spent more time, some time at the ranch, but never as a fox ranch. But we'd go out there and for a week or so, and they spent a lot more time there than I did. Like I said, I was big and strong, so I started working on the fishing boats when I was 13 years old. So I was gone every year for about 3 months in the summertime. And then I'd come back for school in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. So you graduated from Petersburg School.
I graduated from Petersburg High School eventually, but being on the Fox Ranch and that first year in town was a disaster, so I lost that year completely. So I actually didn't graduate from high school until I was 20 years old.
That would have been 1934.
That's 1934, yes.
Let's back up a bit and talk a little about your parents. Your father came north, was it for the gold rush?
Well, he didn't come north for the gold rush, but he came north because he wanted a prospect, and he felt that Alaska was a place to do it in. And so when he was 16 years old, he left his folks in the Puget Sound area and came into Wrangell, Alaska, which is only about 35 miles south of Petersburg. And he had a brother there in Wrangell at the time, and they went, they used to go prospecting, and quite often, most of the time, was in up the Stickeen River. Tributary up there was referred to as the Iskoot River. They made several trips up there. This all happened in 98. That's when he came to Alaska. So he came to Alaska in 98, and for some reason or other, my mother took care of his mother for many years, and the two corresponded all these years. And in 1912, my mother wrote to him in Wrangell and says, "If you want me, come and get me. I'm not going to wait any longer." So Dad went outside. That was the last time he was ever out to the South 48 states. And married my mother and brought her back to Petersburg. Their wedding supper that night, their wedding day, happened to be popcorn balls. And that was on the 9th of December in 1912.
So, after high school, what were your plans? Did you want to go to college right away, or were you looking into the possibility of working for a while?
Well, I decided several years before that I didn't think that I wanted to be a fisherman or a logger or anything the rest of my life. The work that I had been doing since I was 13 years old, so I decided that I would eventually go on to college, but I didn't know for sure what I wanted to take up. When I was a kid, of course, on the Fox Ranch, I wanted to be a chicken farmer. But later on, I decided I either wanted to go into forestry or I wanted to go into mining. I had a cousin that graduated from forestry, and he thought that that was a profession to follow. And yet, I'd followed my father around the hills enough to know that I was very much interested in breaking rock and panning and things involving the mineral industry. So I was up in the air for some time. But so I was talking this over with my folks in the fall of 35, and I says, well, I'm going to work two or three more years and accumulate some money, and I'll have enough then to start going to the university. And my mother spoke up and she says, well, you don't have to wait, you can go right away. So, because it was my habit of, if I earned a few dollars more than I was spending, I'd give it to my mother, thinking that she needed it, and I didn't ever dream that she was socking it away instead of spending it herself. So I had, I guess, $400 or $500 she had saved from what I had given her. So that was enough to get me started at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Of course, at that time there was only one college in Alaska. I did correspond with other colleges, but University of Alaska was the most reasonable university to go to, and it almost guaranteed students work during the summer, and a lot of them were able to earn money during the winter time as janitors or coal haulers or snow shovelers or something around the campus. So that's the reason I chose to come to Fairbanks. So the fall of 45, I came up.
This is fall of 35?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Fall of 35, I left Petersburg on the steamer and came to Seward, and then a two-day trip by train put me in Fairbanks, and I started at the University of Alaska in 35.
I bet Bunnell was there to meet you, or you met him shortly afterwards.
I met Charles Bunnell, the founder of the university, almost immediately, and he was a great guy. In fact, he was actually too lenient on some of us students that used to pull so many pranks on one another. But he seemed to consider the source and let us by when he certainly shouldn't have.
So you had the $400, or about $400, to start school when you came up. And did you get a job right away at that point, or did you wait until you had run out of money before you had to?
Well, I got a job almost immediately as janitor, which gave me a little board and room. And then the spring semester, in 36, I borrowed $400 from the student loan fund. And the next, that summer, after school, I got a job with the Fairbanks Exploration Company. And I made enough that year in the mining field, to pay back my $400 student loan and accumulate enough for the second semester. Or the first semester of my second year. And that continued throughout my years, 5 years of schooling. And I graduated only owing $400.
So almost debt-free.
Almost debt-free.
That's pretty good. You don't get by that
with that little, this day and age. What were your living accommodations like? I guess some students lived in dorms, but there were some very unique structures.
Yes, I lived in the dorm most of the time. However, one semester I tried living in a what they call a yurt, which is a kind of a mud abode, moss cut in huge blocks, 2 or 3 feet in diameter, and stacked one on top of another, and forming a dome-shaped structure. And there was one window in it, and about a 8 or 10 inch ventilator that stuck out of the room for a roof for a ventilation, and a stovepipe and safety, and for a stove, and a kind of a entrance that allowed a person to come in through two doors, in other words, a storm entrance. And those yurches were very warm. They only required to stoke the stove once or twice a day, and that furnished enough heat for your cooking and heat for the cabin. And these yurches probably numbered in the neighborhood of 24 or so at the foot of the college hill. And today there's none available, but they'd all be located probably along University Avenue and from Wolf Run or Geist Road to the College Road. There wasn't any Geist Road or University Avenue in those days, but that's the approximate location of most of them through that area and across the railroad tracks. And I remember that the railroad was, we had a once a day train, and we always would have to make sure that there wasn't any stop signs, of course, and we'd have to watch out for ourselves. And we lived mostly on moose meat and rabbits, so it was, and we'd cut our own wood. Dr. Bunnell owned most of these yurches down there, and so he charged us $5 a month for rent. And I remember my kerosene bill for my lamp was in the neighborhood of $6 a month. So in that particular case, our light bill was more than our rent bill.
So these yurts looked really like big mud igloos from your description.
Yes.
And they were about 10 feet in diameter?
They're probably 10 foot, 12 foot maximum inside dimension.
So cozy for one person.
And maybe 7 feet high. You had you had headroom, but not too much. Mm-hmm. And it was all kerosene lamps. A few of the people tried to have these Aladdin lamps, but the cabins were so well insulated and so forth that the mantles would blacken and they were more or less useless. But a kerosene lamp required less air, so we could get by with them.
Well, it sounds like you were busy just with working, going to school, and living under pretty tough conditions in terms of having to cut your own wood and things like that. Did you ever have time for recreation, sports, for instance?
Well, yes, I always had time for some sports. I was on the ski team for many years, and after the experienced skiers, after they graduated and got out of there, I was able to win a first-class prize in cross-country work. But I always loved skiing and had a pair of skis from when my first year is there to my last. We had a little ski cabin that we all used practically every night during the winter. That was located out on Blaine's Blaine Road, which went, at that time, stopped at the Farmer's Loop entrance, but now if you projected that over Goldstream, into Goldstream, it followed along that route, and at the foot of the hill was our cabin. That's somewhere near where George...
This be near the Pearl Creek Farm?
Yes, it would be in that general area. Gordon Herod has a strawberry farm in there now.
So what did you use for illumination?
And we used a carbide lamp for illumination, and we'd head out 10, 11 o'clock at night, many nights, and just ski out there and get a cup of coffee. It seemed like somebody was there ahead of us all the time, and coffee pot was always on, so we'd ski out for a cup or two of coffee and then ski back. And colder days, of course, our headlights were run by carbide and water, so they'd have a tendency to freeze up, so our girlfriends would knit parkas for our headlights so that we would have light for an hour or so during the, which it took us to make that trip, depending on how dark it was and what our obstacles were along the route, and if we had to break a lot of deep snow or so forth. But we considered that about a, at that time, we considered that a 3 mile run. And then I was a manager of the hockey team 1 year, and I was assistant manager another time for basketball. So I was involved with sports, but I was never good enough to get on a team.
Do you remember some of your professors, any special stories about them?
Well, I remember several of the professors. Dr. Bramhall was our physics professor, and Dr. Bastris was our chemistry professor, and I remember him. Not all of us were enough background in chemistry to keep up with him. He was always 10 jumps ahead of us, and he'd put a big long formula on the board and say, look at it two or three times, and he would say, well, that's obvious. So he'd erase it immediately and before we could copy it down, and that exasperated us no end. And then our mining professors, a fellow by the name of Skook Hendrickson, was one of our favorites, and George Fenton, or Henton, I should say. He was a metallurgical professor. And Lester Dawson was a math professor. Russ Huber was our military science professor. And there were several others that I guess I'd have to think about a while.
Now, was military science a required course? Did you take it all 4 years in school, or was this something that you took maybe only one semester?
No, it was a two-year course. It was referred to as military science at that time, not ROTC, mm-hmm. So they had no credit, but it was compulsory to take. And we had to wear what we used to call monkey suits. They were a kind of a green or blue gabardine uniforms, shirt and pants matching. I don't think there's anything colder in the world than those uniforms. And of course, we had to perform every spring during the carnival time in Fairbanks, That meant we had a parade up and down First Cushman Street and First Avenue. And I remember Russ Huber on one occasion dismissed us right in front of what we used to, or what was then called the China Bar on First Avenue. It was down probably downstream a little bit from Barnett and First Avenue. And he realized his mistake just a little bit too late. So we had, the China Bar had a 20 or 30 military science recruits in there all of a sudden, and with their rifles stacked all over the place. But we'll always thank Russ for dismissing us at that particular point so we could get in out of the weather in a hurry and get a quick beer.
Yeah, I guess it was still pretty cold then. If it was the carnival, it would have been in March.
Yes, it was. It was well below zero most of the time.
So after graduation, you're the class of 1940?
1940.
What did you do after graduation?
Well, before graduation, every year I worked for the mining companies around, and I only worked for 2 years with the U.S. Smelting Refining Company, known as the F.E. Company, but 38, 39, and 40, I was with Ted Matthews at American Creek, and worked on the dredge there, and the point field, and the thaw field, and got a lot of experience in placer mining. In those three, my last 3 years in school, and then the first year out of school, 1940, summer of 41, I should say, 40 and 41, and I helped build a dredge up Caribou Creek. It was called the Caribou Creek Dredge, owned by two fellows by the name of Brinker and Johnson. And that was the last gold operation I worked on before the war. I came out of Caribou Creek in November of 41, and of course, you know that war broke out. Pearl Harbor happened on the December 7th in 41, and we were told ahead of time that there wouldn't be any more mining for gold or non-strategic minerals for the duration. So we were prepared. So instead of, I tried to enlist that year, that time, but I had a bum left eye, so they decided that I wasn't eligible to enlist at the for the time being. So I joined, I went to work for the Army Engineers at Ladfield, now known as Fort Wainwright. And that was, and I worked with them until 1943, when my draft number came up. And that time they just felt me to see if I was warm, and I went from a civilian boss of about 50 field surveyors to PFC, earning $60 a month. But I kept my same job, and outside of changing a uniform and pay, nothing different changed. I still had my crew and my job to do, and so that continued on through. 1942 is when we started to build Eielson Air Force Base. At that time it was known as 26 Mile Satellite Field. Morrison Knudsen was the prime contractor on that field, and I was the liaison, or the project engineer, was kind of a go-between between the resident engineer at LAD and the contractor. So we built two 5,000-foot runways and a birchwood hangar and quite a few support buildings, all for $7 million. And so that was my first, from then on I had a rating of a construction supervisor, airport construction supervisor. And so from then on I was on runway construction for the duration, serving in Northway and Galena and Nome, and finally ended up in Anchorage in the mainland division. In the meantime, I also was involved with freighting down the Tanana and Yukon rivers to Galena. That was the year of the big flood and the year that the Galena was being rebuilt and on higher ground. So we contracted for a lot of fuel to go down by river boat. And much of the fuel had to be floated down in kind of containers, log containers. There wasn't enough barges on the river to freight all the fuel that was required, so a lot of the natives and people along the Yukon and Tanana that had an outboard motor and open boats were giving small contracts. They had 100 drum or so at a time, and they'd dump them in the Tanana at Nenana and put a boom around them with logs and float them down the Tanana and then the Yukon and end up catching them all at the point there at Galena. Surprising, we only lost less than 10% of our fuel, and which was considered a pretty good record for somewhat 400 miles of river transportation.
Well, I'll say with all the logs that can hang up boats and
sandbars many a time the whole raft would get stuck on a sandbar and have to be pulled off, and then those drums would have to be yarded together again. And so it was no small task, but the devotion to duty made it all possible.